3. From Traveler to Tourist, The Lost Art of Travel. You're just 15 gourmet meals from Europe on the world's fastest ship. Advertisement for the United States Lines. During recent decades, we have come to think that our new technology can save us from the inexorable laws of familiarity. By magical modern machinery, we hope to clear the world of its commonplaceness, of its omnipresent tree sparrows, starlings, and blue jays, and fill it with rare Sutton's warblers, ivory-billed woodpeckers, whooping cranes, and rufous hummingbirds. Every birdwatcher knows how hard it is to reconcile oneself to the fact that the common birds are the ones most usually seen, and that rare birds are really quite uncommon. Now, all of us frustrate ourselves by the expectation that we can make the exotic an everyday experience, without it ceasing to be exotic, and can somehow make commonplaceness itself disappear. The word adventure has become one of the blandest and emptiest in the language. The cheap cafeteria at the corner offers us an adventure in good eating, a course in self-development, $13.95. In a few weeks, we'll transform our daily conversation into a great adventure. To ride in the new Dodge is an adventure. By continual overuse, we wear out the once common meaning of an unusual, stirring experience, often of romantic nature, and return adventure to its original meaning of a mere happening. From the Latin adventura, or advenire. But an adventure was originally that which happens without design, chance, hap, luck. Now in common usage, it is primarily a contrived experience that somebody is trying to sell us. Its changed meaning is both a symptom of the new pervasiveness of pseudo-events and a symbol of how we defeat ourselves by our exaggerated expectations of the amount of unexpectedness, adventure, as of everything else in the world. There is no better illustration of our newly exaggerated expectations than our changed attitude toward travel. One of the most ancient motives for travel, when men had any choice about it, was to see the unfamiliar. Man's incurable desire to go someplace else is a testimony of his incurable optimism and insatiable curiosity. We always expect things to be different over there. Traveling, Descartes wrote in the early 17th century, is almost like conversing with men of other centuries. Men who move because they are starved or frightened or oppressed expect to be safer, better fed, and more free in the new place. Men who live in a secure, rich, and decent society travel to escape boredom, to elude the familiar, and to discover the exotic. They have often succeeded. Great stirrings of the mind have frequently followed great ages of travel. Throughout history, by going to far places and seeing strange sights, men have prodded their imagination. They have found amazement and delight, and have reflected that life back home need not always remain what it has been. They have learned that there is more than one way to skin a cat, that there are more things in heaven and earth than was dreamt of in their philosophy, that the possibilities of life are not exhausted on Main Street. In the 15th century, the discovery of the Americas, the voyages around Africa and to the Indies, opened eyes, enlarged thought, and helped create the Renaissance. The travels of the 17th century around Europe, to America, and to the Orient helped awaken men to ways of life different from their own and led to the Enlightenment. The discovery of new worlds has always renewed men's minds. Travel has been the universal catalyst. It has made men think faster, imagine larger, want more passionately. The returning traveler brings home disturbing ideas. Pascal, 3 centuries before television, said that man's ills came from the fact that he had not yet learned to sit quietly in a room. In recent decades, more Americans than ever before have traveled outside our country. In 1854, about 30-odd thousand Americans went abroad. A century later, in 1954, almost a million American citizens left the United States for foreign parts other than Canada and Mexico. After allowing for the increase in population, there is about 5 times as much foreign travel by Americans nowadays as there was 100 years ago. As a nation, we are probably the most traveled people of our time or of any time. What is remarkable, on reflection, is not that our foreign travel has increased so much, but rather that all this travel has made so little difference in our thinking and feeling. Our travels have not, it seems, made us noticeably more cosmopolitan or more understanding of other peoples. The explanation is not that Americans are any more obtuse or uneducable than they used to be. Rather, the travel experience itself has been transformed. Many Americans now travel, yet few are travelers in the old sense of the word. The multiplication, improvement, and cheapening of travel facilities have carried many more people to distant places. But the experience of going there, the experience of being there, and what is brought back from there are all very different. The experience has become diluted, contrived, prefabricated. The modern American tourist now fills his experience with pseudo-events. He has come to expect both more strangeness and more familiarity than the world naturally offers. He has come to believe that he can have a lifetime of adventure in 2 weeks and all the thrills of risking his life without any real risk at all. He expects that the exotic and the familiar can be made to order, that a nearby vacation spot can give him old-world charm, and also that if he chooses the right accommodations, he can have the comforts of home in the heart of Africa. Expecting all this, he demands that it be supplied to him. Having paid for it, he likes to think he has got his money's worth. He has demanded that the whole world be made a stage for pseudo-events, and there has been no lack of honest and enterprising suppliers who try to give him what he wants, to help him inflate his expectations, and to gratify his insatiable appetite for the impossible. 1. Until almost the present century, travel abroad was uncomfortable, difficult, and expensive. The middle-class American did not go for fun. Foreign capitals offered sophisticated pleasures, conversation with the great and the witty, views of painting, sculpture, and architecture, romantic musings in the ruins of vanished civilizations, pilgrimages to the birthplaces of poets, to the scenes of glory of statesmen and orators. Men seeing the wonders of the world felt a wonderment for which they usually were well prepared. This had long been the pattern of European travel by Europeans. As soon as we have got hold of a bit of Latin, the French wit Saint-Evremond caricatured in one of his comedies in the 17th century, we prepare to start on our travels. When our travelers are of a literary turn of mind, they invariably take with them a book consisting solely of blank pages nicely bound, which they call an album amicorum. Armed with this, they make a point of calling on the various learned men of the locality they happen to be visiting and beg them to inscribe their names in it. The serious attitude in the late 18th century was expressed by an aristocratic scholar, the Comte de Vonnet, who explained that, having received a small inheritance, on reflection, I thought the sum too inconsiderable to make any sensible addition to my income, and too great to be dissipated in frivolous expenses. Some fortunate circumstances had habituated me to study. I had acquired a taste and even a passion for knowledge, and the accession to my fortune appeared to me a fresh means of gratifying my inclination and opening a new way to improvement. I had read, and frequently heard repeated, that of all methods of adorning the mind and forming the judgment, traveling is the most efficacious. I determined, therefore, on a plan of traveling. But to what part of the world to direct my course remains still to be chosen. I wish the scene of my observations to be new, or at least brilliant. Volney decided to go to the Middle East. In his journey through Syria and Egypt, 1783-85, produced a travel classic. Arthur Young, the English agriculturalist, took three trips to nearby France in 1787, 1788, and 1789 as a self-appointed surveyor of farming ways. His journal, published 1792, helped revolutionize the agronomy of England and reached its influence far out to the young United States. Jefferson, in France and Italy about the same time, earnestly sought out new plants for Virginia and found the architectural models which shaped the University of Virginia. The young aristocrat went abroad also to grow up and to sow his wild oats. He could enjoy his rakish pleasures at a comfortable distance from home and reputation. Adam Smith, in The Wealth of Nations, 1776, recorded that in his day it was the custom among those who could afford it to send young people to travel in foreign countries immediately upon their leaving school and without sending them to any university. Our young people, it is said, generally return home much improved by their travels. A young man who goes abroad at 17 or 18 and returns home at 21 returns 3 or 4 years older than he was when he went abroad, and at that age it is very difficult not to improve a good deal in 3 or 4 years. Smith objected, however, that this was a risky practice which often corrupted the young. The custom, he said, could not have arisen except for the low state of English universities. The wealth of England had enabled her young people on the continent, as a German observer somewhat enviously remarked in 1760, to give a loose to their propensities to pleasure, even in Italy. Having a great deal of money to lavish away, it not only gives them more spirit to engage in adventures, but likewise furnishes them with the means for removing impediments or buying off any ill consequences. Casanova's amorous memoirs, 1826-38, we sometimes forget were a record of travels which had taken him through the capitals of Europe, to Venice, Paris, Berlin, Warsaw, Madrid, and as far east as Constantinople. In the 17th and 18th centuries, many European men of culture liked to boast of having made more than one country their own. To travel was to become a man of the world. Unless one was a man of the world, he might not seem cultivated in his own country. The young Italian Antonio Conti, for example, as Paul Hazard recalls, was born in Padua, lived for a while in Paris, then in London in 1715, joined a discussion of the recently invented infinitesimal calculus. Afterwards, stopped to pay his respect to Leeuwenhoek, the naturalist and microscope maker in Holland, all on his way to meet the philosopher Leibniz in Hanover. In the old grand tour, recounted, for example, in Lawrence Stern's Sentimental Journey, the young gentleman rounded off his education. Locke, Gibbon, and Hume knew France from extended visits. Gibbon did much of his writing in Switzerland. Monarchs often went abroad, and not only when they abdicated or were banished. Prince Hamlet went abroad to study. Christina of Sweden lived for a while in Paris and died in Rome in 1689. Peter the Great, at the end of the 17th century, traveled in Germany, Holland, England, and Austria. For Europeans, foreign travel was an institution of exiled monarchs, adventuring aristocrats, merchant princes, and wandering scholars. For Americans, too, until nearly the end of the 19th century, foreign travel, still mostly European travel, was the experience of a privileged few. Franklin's great overseas success was in the committee rooms of the House of Commons and in the salons and bedrooms of Paris. Jefferson and other cultivated Americans, who still believed in a worldwide republic of letters, were eager to meet their European fellow citizens. Henry Adams in Berlin, Rome, London, Paris was an idealized American version of the European on grand tour. All the success that Adams or his father or grandfather achieved, so Henry said, was chiefly due to the field that Europe gave them. And it was more than likely that without the help of Europe, they would have all remained local politicians or lawyers, like their neighbors, to the end. When a Franklin, a Jefferson, a Charles Sumner, or a Henry Adams arrived in Europe, he was armed with introductions to the great and famous. Henry Adams called the European journey his third or fourth attempt at education. Like other means of education, such travel had its delights, but it was hard work. The scarcity of postal facilities and the lack of newspapers gave an added incentive to travel. At the same time, the hardships of a virtually roadless landscape restricted the foreign journey to those with a serious, or at least earnestly frivolous, purpose, who were willing to risk robbers, cutthroats, and disease, and to find their own way through trackless heath, vast swamps, and mud that came up to the carriage axles. Under the best of conditions, one historian of the 18th century records, 6 horses were required to drag across country the lumbering coaches of the gentry, and not infrequently the assistance of oxen was required. It was not until nearly 1800, and the work of 2 Scottish engineers, Thomas Telford and John McAdam, that the modern science of road building was developed, and cheap and effective hard surfacing became possible. The travel experience was an adventure, too, simply because so few could afford or would dare its hardships. The modern hotel, the place which George Bernard Shaw later praised as a refuge from home life, had not been invented. In the picturesque inn of the travel books, every comfort had to be specially negotiated. The luxury of a private bed was hard to come by, not only because of the constant companionship of cockroaches, bedbugs, and fleas, but because innkeepers felt free to assign more than one guest to a bed. Englishmen traveling in France noted how rare it was to encounter fellow travelers, much less fellow countrymen. Arthur Young, in the late 18th century, found a paucity of travelers that is amazing. He traveled a whole day on a main road 30 miles outside of Paris and met but a single gentleman's carriage, nor anything else on the road that looked like a gentleman. Even later, when sleeping accommodations had improved, the traveler on the continent might expect to find comfortable hotels, but no uncomfortable crowds. As late as the 1860s, an English traveler to Holland noted that tourists were comparatively rare, and there were no cheap trippers. 2. Sometime past the middle of the 19th century, as the graphic revolution was getting underway, the character of foreign travel, first by Europeans and then by Americans, began to change. This change has reached its climax in our day. Formerly, travel required long planning, large expense, and great investments of time. It involved risks to health or even to life. The traveler was active. Now he became passive. Instead of an athletic exercise, travel became a spectator sport. This change can be described in a word. It was the decline of the traveler and the rise of the tourist. There is a wonderful but neglected precision in these words. The old English noun travel, in the sense of a journey, was originally the same word as travail, meaning trouble, work, or torment. And the word travail, in turn, seems to have been derived through the French from a popular Latin or common Romanic word, trapalium, which meant a 3-staked instrument of torture. To journey, to travail, or later to travel, then was to do something laborious or troublesome. The traveler was an active man at work. In the early 19th century, a new word came into the English language, which gave a clue to the changed character of world travel, especially from the American point of view. This was the word tourist, at first hyphenated as T-O-U-R-I-S-T. Our American dictionary now defines tourist as a person who makes a pleasure trip, or a person who makes a tour especially for pleasure. Significantly, too, The word tour in tourist was derived by back formation from the Latin tornus, which in turn came from the Greek word for a tool describing a circle. The traveler then was working at something. The tourist was a pleasure seeker. The traveler was active. He went strenuously in search of people, of adventure, of experience. The tourist is passive. He expects interesting things to happen to him. He goes sightseeing. A word, by the way, which came in about the same time, with its first use recorded in 1847. He expects everything to be done to him and for him. Thus, foreign travel ceased to be an activity, an experience, an undertaking, and instead became a commodity. The rise of the tourist was possible, and then inevitable, when attractive items of travel were wrapped up and sold in packages, the package tour. By buying a tour, you could oblige somebody else to make pleasant and interesting things happen to you. You could buy wholesale, by the month or week or by the country, or retail, by the day or by the individual foreign capital. The familiar circumstances which had brought this about are worth recalling. First and most obvious was the easing of transportation. In the latter part of the 19th century, railroads and ocean steamers began to make travel actually pleasurable. Discomfort and risks were suddenly reduced. For the first time in history, long-distance transportation was industrially mass-produced. It could be sold to lots of people, and it could be sold cheap. For a satisfactory return on investment, it had to be sold in large quantities. The capital invested in any of the old vehicles, a stagecoach or the passenger quarters in a sailing ship, was minute compared to that in a railroad, even a single sleeping car, or a luxury liner. This enormous capital investment required that equipment be kept in constant use and that passengers be found by the thousands. Now, great numbers of people would be induced to travel for pleasure. Vast ocean steamers could not be filled with diplomats, with people traveling on business, or with aristocratic Henry Adamses who were intent on deepening their education. The consuming public had to be enlarged to include the vacationing middle class, or at least the upper middle class. Foreign travel became democratized. The obvious next step was the personally conducted tour. Well-planned group excursions could entice even the more timid stay-at-homes. Of course, guided tours of one sort or another had been very old. The Crusades had sometimes taken on this character. We can recall in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, in the late 14th century, the knowledgeable, generous host of the Tabard Inn, who offered, "And for to make yow the more merry, I will myself in goodly with yow ride, right at mine own cost and be your guide." But later guides seldom offered their services free. The guided tour itself actually became a commodity. Adventure would be sold in packages and guaranteed to be consumed without risk. In England, with its short distances, its rising middle classes, and its early developed railroads, came the first organized tours. According to legend, the very first of them was arranged in 1838 to take the people of Wadebridge by special train to the nearby town of Bodmin. There, they witnessed the hanging of two murderers. Since the Bodmin gallows were in clear sight of the uncovered station, excursionists had their fun without even leaving the open railway carriages. The real pioneer in the making and marketing of conducted tours was, of course, Thomas Cook, 1808-1892. He began in the early 1840s by arranging special-rate railroad excursions within England. His first planned tour took nearly 600 people the 11 miles from Leicester to Loughborough for a temperance convention, at a reduced round-trip third-class fare of 1 shilling a head. Soon, Cook was sending hundreds to Scotland, 1846, and Ireland, 1848, and for thousands was arranging tours of the Crystal Palace Exposition in London in 1851. In 1856, he advertised his first Grand Circular Tour of the Continent, visiting Antwerp, Brussels, the field of Waterloo, Cologne, the Rhine and its borders, Mayence, Frankfurt, Heidelberg, Baden-Baden, Strasbourg, Paris, Le Havre, and back to London. Then, with the help of his enterprising son, he offered Swiss tours, American tours, and finally, in 1869, the first middle-class conducted crusade to the Holy Land. He quickly developed all kinds of conveniences, courteous and knowledgeable guides, hotel coupons, room reservations, and protection and advice against disease and thievery. Sophisticated Englishmen objected. They said that Cook was depriving travelers of initiative and adventure and cluttering the continental landscape with the Philistine middle classes. "Going by railroad," complained John Ruskin, "I do not consider as traveling at all. It is merely being sent to a place, and very little different from becoming a parcel." An article in Blackwood's Magazine in February 1865 by a British consul in Italy attacked this new and growing evil of conducting some 40 or 50 persons, irrespective of age or sex, from London to Naples and back for a fixed sum. "The cities of Italy," he lamented, "were now deluged with droves of these creatures, for they never separate, and you see them 40 in number pouring along a street with their director, now in front, now at the rear, circling round them like a sheepdog. And really, the process is as like herding as may be. I have already met 3 flocks, and anything so uncouth I never saw before. The men, mostly elderly, dreary, sad-looking, the women, somewhat younger, travel-tossed, but intensely lively, wide-awake, and facetious." Cook defended his tours, which he called agencies for the advancement of human progress. The attacks on them, he said, were sheer snobbery. The critics belonged in some earlier century. How foolish to think that places of rare interest should be excluded from the gaze of the common people and be kept only for the interest of the selective society. But it is too late in this day of progress to talk of such exclusive nonsense. God's earth, with all its fullness and beauty, is for the people, and railways and steamboats are the result of the common light of science and are for the people also. The best of men and the noblest of minds rejoice to see people follow in their foretrod routes of pleasure. Still, in the United States, where everything was suddenly available to everybody, it was far more profitable to deal in immigrants than in tourists. Mobile, immigrant-filled, primitive America saw less glamour in travel, whether at home or abroad. Among Americans, even longer than among Englishmen, foreign travel remained close to its aristocratic origins. Until early in the 20th century, Americans who wanted a planned European excursion still relied on Thomas Cook and Son. President Grant used Cook's, and one of the best testimonials for Cook's new foolproof carefree travel commodity came from Mark Twain. "Cook has made travel easy and a pleasure. He will sell you a ticket to any place on the globe, or all the places, and give you all the time you need and much more besides. It provides hotels for you everywhere if you so desire, and you cannot be overcharged, for the coupons show just how much you must pay. Cook's servants at the great stations will attend to your baggage, get you a cab, tell you how much to pay cabmen and porters, procure guides for you, and horses, donkeys, camels, bicycles, or anything else you want, and make life a comfort and satisfaction to you. Cook is your banker everywhere, and his establishment your shelter when you get caught out in the rain. His clerks will answer all the questions you ask and do it courteously. I recommend your grace to travel on Cook's tickets, and I do this without embarrassment, for I get no commission. I do not know Cook." Cook's never lost its early leadership. It is still the largest travel agency in the world. The principal competitor in the United States was to be the American Express Company. It grew out of the famous Wells Fargo and other agencies, which by the mid-19th century were forwarding goods and money across the vast American spaces. In the 19th century, these agencies profited from the immigrant influx by going into the business of arranging remittances from successful, recently arrived Americans to their needy families back in Europe. In 1891, the first American Express traveler's check was copyrighted, and in the years since, it has done much to ease the traveler's cares. By 1960, about $2 billion worth were being sold annually. In 1895, American Express opened its first European office. At first, all it offered traveling Americans was a mail forwarding service, help in securing railroad tickets and hotel reservations, and help in finding lost baggage. President James C. Fargo, in charge until 1914, insisted there was no money in the tourist business. American Express, he said, should deal exclusively in freight and express. But the consolidation of the different express services as part of the war effort in World War I inevitably changed the business. Even before the end of the war, American Express had begun to develop an extensive travel service. And after the war, its travel department grew spectacularly. By 1961, American Express, serving tourists everywhere, had 279 offices throughout the world. American Express sent the first post-war escorted tour to Europe in October 1919. Soon afterwards, the first Mediterranean cruise went out in the Cunard liner Caronia under joint control of American Express and Cook's. In 1922, American Express dispatched the first all-water round-the-world pleasure cruise in the Laconia. Afterwards, a similar cruise was arranged every year. The great backwash had begun. Americans were returning to the old world in the great tourist invasions of Europe, which have fluctuated with our domestic fortunes, but which in recent years have been greater than ever before. By the middle of the 20th century, foreign travel had become big business. It was a prominent feature of the American standard of living, an important element in our cultural and financial relations with the rest of the world. In 1957, for example, about 10 million American residents spent over $2 billion on international travel. Of these travelers, 1.5 million went overseas. For the summer of 1961 alone, it was estimated that 800,000 Americans were visiting Europe and were spending there about $700 million. Foreign travel now had, of course, become a commodity. Like any other mass-produced commodity, it could be bought in bargain packages and on the installment plan. It was considered a strange and noteworthy event, a peculiar quirk, when Charles Sumner, in early 19th century Boston, borrowed money from a couple of old friends who had faith in his future to finance his tour of Europe. Nowadays, more and more travelers take the trip before they can pay for it. Go now, pay later. Your travel agent will arrange it for you. When travel is no longer made to order, but is an assembly line, store-bought commodity, we have less to say about what goes into it. And we know less and less about what we are buying. We buy so many days of vacation pleasure without even knowing what is in the package. Recently, on a lecture tour, I flew into Hyderabad, a city in central India, of which I had not even heard of a year before. Seated beside me on the plane were a tired, elderly American and his wife. He was a real estate broker from Brooklyn. I asked him what was interesting about Hyderabad. He had not the slightest notion. He and his wife were going there because the place was in the package. Their tour agent had guaranteed to include only places that were world famous, and so it must be. A well-packaged tour must include insurance against risks. In this sense, the dangers of travel have become obsolete. We buy safety and peace of mind right in the package. Somebody else covers all the risks. In 1954, the suspense thriller movie The High and the Mighty depicted the troubled flight of a luxury airliner from San Francisco to Honolulu. The assorted vacationers aboard were flying to the mid-Pacific for a week or two of relaxation. As the engines failed, the nerves of the passengers began to fray. Finally, in order to keep the plane in the air, the captain ordered the baggage jettisoned. I saw this movie in a suburban theater outside of Chicago. Beside me sat a mother and her young son. He seemed relatively unperturbed at the mortal risks of the passengers. But when the plane's purser began tossing into the ocean the elegant vacation paraphernalia, fancy suitcases, hat boxes, portable typewriters, golf clubs, tennis rackets, the boy became agitated. "What will they do?" the boy exclaimed. "Don't worry," comforted the mother. "It's all insured." When the traveler's risks are insurable, he has become a tourist. 3. The traveler used to go about the world to encounter the natives. A function of travel agencies now is to prevent this encounter. They are always devising efficient new ways of insulating the tourist from the travel world. In the old traveler's accounts, the colorful native innkeeper, full of sage advice and local lore, was a familiar figure. Now he is obsolete. Today, on Main Street in your hometown, you can arrange transportation, food, lodging and entertainment for Rome, Sydney, Singapore, or Tokyo. No more chaffering. A well-planned tour saves the tourist from negotiating with the natives when he gets there. One reason why returning tourists nowadays talk so much about and are so irritated by tipping practices is that these are almost their only direct contact with the people. Even this may soon be eliminated. The Travel Plant Commission of the International Union of Official Travel Organizations in 1958 was studying ways of standardizing tipping practices so that eventually all gratuities could be included in the tour package. Shopping, like tipping, is one of the few activities remaining for the tourist. It is a chink in that wall of pre-arrangements which separates him from the country he visits. No wonder he finds it exciting. When he shops, he actually encounters natives, negotiates in their strange language, and discovers their local business etiquette. In a word, he tastes the thrill and travail which the old-time traveler once experienced all along the way, with every purchase of transportation, with every night's lodging, with every meal. A planned excursion insulates the tourist in still another way. From its first invention by Thomas Cook in the early 19th century, the fully prearranged group tour promised good fellowship with one's countrymen, in addition to the exotic pleasure of foreign sights, the luxury ocean liner and the all-expense cruise. The word in this sense is very recent and is possibly an American invention. Originally, it meant to sail from place to place as for pleasure, without a set destination. Have made this kind of travel amount to residence in a floating resort hotel. Shipmates now replace the natives as a source of adventure. Unadvertised risks from pickpockets and bandits are replaced by over-advertised risks of shipboard romance. The sights which disappoint the bachelor or spinster on a cruise are not the Vatican, the Louvre, or the Acropolis, but the shipmates. Except for tipping and shopping adventures, returning cruisers have little to report about encounters with the natives, but they have a great deal to say about their countrymen on tour with them. The authorized centennial history of American Express recounts the tribulations of a cruise director on a round-the-world cruise. He was obliged, among other things, to rescue a susceptible young playboy from the wiles of a cruising adventuress, play Cupid to a British baronet and an American actress, guard the widow of an Australian pearl magnate who carried tin cans full of matched pearls loose in her baggage, quietly settle an attempted murder in Calcutta, protect his charges during the pitched battle with which Hindus and Mohammedans celebrated the harvest festival in Agra, reason with a passenger who demanded a refund because he lost a day when the ship crossed the international dateline, and hold the hand of a lonely old lady as she lay dying in a hotel in Rome. In the old days, an excursion director was called a guide. Now he is a social director. Of course, the voyager, even on a planned excursion, is likely to be less insulated on land than on sea, and he is least insulated if he goes alone. But the notion of package touring has so prevailed that when a person goes by himself, the American Express Travel Department gives his package a special name, FIT or DIT, for Foreign or Domestic Independent Travel. If you want to buy a vacation tour package all for yourself, that is, voyage alone and at will, this is actually offered as a special feature. It is described as an attractive new departure from the routine group arrangements, much as only a half century ago the group excursion was offered as something special. The individualized package, the American Express Chronicler explains, is for individuals who prefer to travel alone rather than in a conducted group. A tour is planned to meet the particular specifications of the client. The extra cost is reckoned, and on payment of this amount, the traveler is given the familiar American Express package containing tickets and coupons to cover his entire trip. Today, more than ever before, the traveler is isolated from the landscape he traverses. The newest and most popular means of passenger transportation to foreign parts is the most insulating known to man. By 1958, about four times as many international travelers from the United States went by air as by sea. Recently, I boarded a plane at Idlewild Airport in New York at 6:31 evening. The next morning, at 11:30, I was in Amsterdam. The flight was routine, at an altitude of about 23,000 feet, far above the clouds, too high to observe landmark or sea mark. Nothing to see but the weather. Since we had no weather, nothing to see at all. I had flown not through space, but through time. My only personal sign that we had gone so far was the discovery on arrival in Amsterdam that I had lost 6 hours. My only problem en route was to pass the time. My passage through space was unnoticeable and effortless. The airplane robbed me of the landscape. The tourist gets there without the experience of having gone. For him, it is all the same, going to one place or to another. Today, it is only by going short distances, which we still traverse on land, that we can have the experience of going any place. When I have driven from Chicago to a summer resort in nearby Indiana or Wisconsin, or when I used to commute from a suburb to the university by train or by car, I have had more variety of sensations, have observed more varied scenes, and have met more varied people than I did when I went from New York to Amsterdam. For ages, the sensations of going there were inseparable from the experience of being there. Nowadays, getting there is half the fun. Rome, announces the British Overseas Airway Corporation, is a fun stop. And there is nothing more homogeneous than fun, wherever it is found. Now we can have plenty en route. United States Lines advertises, "You're just 15 gourmet meals from Europe on the world's fastest ship. Caviar from Iran, pheasant from Scotland. You can choose superb food from all over the world. Another rewarding experience in gracious living on this ship. There's a pool, gym, 2 theaters, 3 Meyer Davis orchestras, it's a 5-day adventure in the lost art of leisure." In an accompanying photograph, we see how Mrs. Leonard Kleckner shows off her dogs to Chief Officer Ridington. This great modern ocean liner has dog kennels with a veterinarian and a dog walking area, shipboard swimming pools, cocktail lounges, and the latest movies. One of the world's great restaurants sails for Europe whenever a Holland America liner pushes off from New York. The experience of going there has been erased. For it, we have substituted all the pleasures of deluxe relaxation, even better than at home. If we go by air, then too we are encompassed in music and enjoy our cocktail in a lounge with the decor of the best resort hotel. In 1961, TWA began showing first-run movies on a special widescreen in the first-class section of its superjet flights. A full-page color advertisement for Lufthansa German Airlines portrays the attractive Miss Dietland von Schönfeld, a typical Lufthansa stewardess of gracious background, poise and charm, intelligence and education, who, of course, speaks fluent English. She invites you to an unusual supper party. Every flight is a charming, informal, continental supper party, 8 jet-smooth miles over the Atlantic. The airline stewardess, a breed first developed in the United States and now found on all major international airlines, is a new subspecies of womankind. With her standardized impersonal charm, she offers us anywhere in the world the same kind of pillow for our head and the latest issue of Look or the Reader's Digest. She is the Madonna of the airways, a pretty symbol of the new homogenized blandness of the tourist's world. The first airline stewardesses were the 8 girls hired by United Airlines on May 15, 1930. Their union was organized in 1946. By 1958, there were 8,200 of them employed by American-owned airlines. They were being trained in a program which lasted about 6 weeks. The general requirements, as a careful reporter summarized them, were that the young lady be 21 to 26 years old, unmarried, reasonably pretty and slender, especially around the hips, which will be at eye level for the passengers. She should have been to high school, be poised and tactful, have a good disposition and a pleasant speaking voice. Stewardesses with similar qualifications were later trained for service on trains and long-distance buses. Cabral's company, which went from Portugal to India in 1500, did not, of course, have the advantage of slender-hipped, smooth-voiced stewardesses. They spent over 6 months at sea. They could not help knowing that they had really gone somewhere. In the days before refrigeration or canning, the passenger cuisine was not for gourmets. Fresh water was rationed, and fresh fruits and vegetables were not to be had. Scurvy was the plague of seafarers. Typhoid, typhus, and malaria were rife. The Mayflower passengers were at sea for nearly 2 months, from mid-September to early November 1620. On arrival, William Bradford reported, "They fell upon their knees and blessed the God of heaven, who had brought them over the vast and furious ocean and delivered them from all the perils and miseries thereof, again to set their feet on the firm and stable earth, their proper element, being thus past the vast ocean and a sea of troubles." Knowledge that they had come so far stayed with them even into the second generation. Increase Mather gave over the first chapter of his catalog of divine providences to remarkable sea deliverances. These were as important in the American experience as were the forests or the Indians. For Americans moving westward in the 19th century, their ways of living together en route shaped their lives on arrival. Just as the proverbial 40 years during which Moses led the children of Israel from Egypt through the wilderness to the Promised Land shaped them into a nation. As westering Americans organized against the perils of the trip, they framed constitutions and bylaws which prepared them to organize new communities at their destinations. Now, when one risks so little and experiences so little on the voyage, the experience of being there somehow becomes emptier and more trivial. When getting there was more troublesome, being there was more vivid. When getting there is fun, arriving there somehow seems not to be arriving any place. The tourist who arrives at his destination, where tourist facilities have been improved, remains almost as insulated as he was en route. Today, the ideal tourist hotel abroad is as much as possible like the best accommodations back home. Beds, lighting facilities, ventilation, air conditioning, central heating, plumbing are all American style, although a shrewd hotel management will, of course, have made a special effort to retain some local atmosphere. Stirred by air travel, international hotel chains have grown phenomenally since World War II. In 1942, Conrad Hilton took over his first hotel outside the United States, the Chihuahua Hilton, just over the border in northern Mexico. I felt, he later recalled, that by organizing weekend bus excursions with guides, large-scale entertainment at the hotel, an all-expenses-paid holiday, we could make a very good thing of it, which we did. At the end of the war, Hilton Hotels International Incorporated was founded. What used to be a month-long vacation trip, Hilton explained, is now almost a weekend possibility. The airplane is here to stay. Americans not only can but want to travel farther, see more, do more in less time. Father Junipero Serra set his California missions a day's journey apart. Today, you can fly over the whole string in a few hours. If we were to set our hotels a day's journey apart, we'd be around the world in no time. So perfectly sound business is in line with national idealism. Hilton changed his slogan from across the nation to around the world. The Caribe Hilton in San Juan, Puerto Rico opened in 1947, the Castellana Hilton in Madrid in 1953, the Istanbul Hilton in 1955, and these were only a beginning. By 1961, Hilton hotels were also operating in Mexico City and Acapulco, Panama City, Montreal, Cairo, West Berlin, St. Thomas Virgin Islands, Santiago, and Honolulu. There were associated hotels in Sydney, Melbourne, and Queensland. Hotels were under construction in Port of Spain, Trinidad, Athens, Amsterdam, and Rotterdam, London, Tehran, and Rome, and projected in Paris, Mayaguez, Puerto Rico, Tokyo, Addis Ababa, Bogota, Dorval, Quebec, and Tunis. The spirit of these new hotels was well expressed in Conrad Hilton's own account of the Istanbul Hilton opening in 1955, to which he brought a plane load of American celebrities and newsmakers. "When we flew into Istanbul for the opening with our guests from America, Carol Channing, Irene Dunne and her husband, Dr. Francis Griffin, Mona Freeman, Sonia Haney, Diana Lynn, Merle Oberon, Ann Miller, representatives of the American press, John Cameron Swayze, Bob Considine, Horace Sutton, Luella Parsons, Hedda Hopper, and Cobina Wright, not to mention my very old friend Leo Carrillo, who once owned a deer named Sequoia, there is no question but that we all felt the antiquity, romance, and mystery of this ancient city. I felt this city of the Golden Horn was a tremendous place to plant a little bit of America. Each of our hotels," Hilton announced at the opening, "is a little America." I have been in both the Caribe Hilton and the Istanbul Hilton, and can testify that both are models of American modernity and antisepsis. They are as indistinguishable in interior feeling and design as two planes of the American Airlines. Except for the views from the picture windows, you do not know where you are. You have the comforting feeling of not really being there. Even the measured admixture of carefully filtered local atmosphere proves that you are still in the USA. 4. The self-conscious effort to provide local atmosphere is itself thoroughly American, and an effective insulation from the place where you have gone. Out of doors, the real Turkey surrounds the Istanbul Hilton, but inside, it is only an imitation of the Turkish style. The hotel achieves the subtle effect, right in the heart of Turkey, of making the experience of Turkey quite second-hand. A similar insulation comes from all the efforts of different countries, which are or hope to become tourist meccas, to provide attractions for tourists. These attractions offer an elaborately contrived indirect experience, an artificial product, to be consumed in the very places where the real thing is free as air. They are ways for the traveler to remain out of contact with foreign peoples in the very act of sightseeing them. They keep the natives in quarantine while the tourist in air-conditioned comfort views them through a picture window. They are the cultural mirages now found at tourist oases everywhere. Oddly enough, many of these attractions came into being, rather accidentally, as byproducts of democratic revolutions. But soon they were being carefully designed, planned in large numbers and on a grand scale by national tourist agencies eager to attract visitors from far away. The modern museum, like the modern tourist himself, is a symptom of the rise of democracy. Both signal the diffusion of scientific knowledge, the popularization of the arts, the decline of private patronage of artists, and the spread of literacy among the middle classes. Collections of valuable, curious, and beautiful objects had always been gathered by men of wealth and power. There had long been private museums, but these were seldom open to the public. In ancient days, and especially before the printed book, museums and libraries had been closely allied, as in Alexandria, for example. Of course, there had always been some works of art especially designed for public display, as in the Pinacotheca, a marble hall of the Propylaeum on the Athenian Acropolis, or in the Forum of Augustus in Rome. At least since Roman times, the best collections of the works of art and of learning were privately owned. And the first modern public museum was the British Museum, established by Act of Parliament in 1753. It had been inspired by the will of Sir Hans Sloane, who on his death that year left the nation his remarkable collection of books, manuscripts, and curiosities. On the European continent, most of the great art museums are part of the booty which the rising middle classes have captured for themselves in the revolution since the late 18th century. The Louvre, which had been a royal palace, became a public art museum after the French Revolution of 1789. Nowadays, a visit to the best art museums in Europe is often a tour of the vacated residences of magnates, noblemen, and monarchs of the pre-democratic age. In Florence, the Uffizi and Pitti palaces. In Venice, the Doge's Palace. In Paris, the Louvre. In Vienna, Schönbrunn. Beautiful objects, taken from scores of princely residences, are crowded together for public display in the grandest of defunct palaces. Painting, sculpture, tapestries, tableware, and other objets d'art, once part of the interior decoration or household equipment of a working aristocracy, were thus liberated by and for the people. Now they were to be shown to the nation and to all comers. Common people could now see treasures from the inner sanctums of palaces, treasures originally designed to adorn the intimate dining tables, bedrooms, and bathrooms of a well-guarded aristocracy. At last, everyone could take a cook's tour of the art of the ages for a nominal admission fee or free of charge. Statesmen saw these new museums as symbols of widespreading education and culture, as monuments and catalysts of national pride. So they were. Today, they remain the destination of tourist pilgrims from afar. To bring the paintings of Botticelli, Rubens, and Titian into a room where one could see them in a few minutes, to gather together the sculpture of Donatello and Cellini from widely dispersed churches, monasteries, and drawing rooms for chronological display in a single hall, to remove the tapestries designed for wall covering in remote mansions and hunting lodges and spread them in the halls of centrally located museums, this was a great convenience. But there was one unavoidable consequence. All these things were being removed from their context. In a sense, therefore, they were all being misrepresented. Perhaps more was gained in the quantity of people who could see them at all than was lost in the quality of the experience. This is not the question. The effect on experience is plain and undeniable. Inevitably, these museums, and others made later on the defunct palace model, became major tourist attractions. They still are. It remains true, however, that almost without exception, whatever one sees in a museum is seen out of its proper surroundings. The impression of individual works of art, or of a country's past culture as a whole, whenever it is formed from museum visits, is inevitably factitious. It has been put together for your and my convenience, instruction, amusement, and delight. But to put it together, The art commissioners have had to take apart the very environment, the culture which was once real, and which actually created and enjoyed these very works. The museum visitor tours a warehouse of cultural artifacts. He does not see vital organs of living culture. Even where, as in the Prado in Madrid or the Hermitage in Leningrad, one visits what once was a private museum, the original collection has been so diluted or expanded, and the atmosphere so changed, that the experience is itself a new artifact. Only the museum itself is quite real, a functioning part of a going concern. The ribbon across the chair, the ancestral portrait no longer viewed by its descendant, is a symbol of the change. Each living art object, taken out of its native habitat so we can conveniently gaze at it, is like an animal in a zoo. Something about it has died in the removal. Of course, there remain sites all over the world: Windsor Castle, the Medici Palace in Florence, the Hindu rock carvings at Elephanta, Japanese imperial palaces, and countless churches, shrines, and temples, where works of art remain in their original sites. But in nearly all tourist meccas, much of the tourist sightseeing is museum seeing, and most museums have this unreal, misrepresentative character. The museum is only one example of the tourist attraction. All tourist attractions share this factitious, pseudo-eventful quality. Formerly, when the old-time traveler visited a country, whatever he saw was apt to be what really went on there. A Titian, a Rubens, or a Gobelin tapestry would be seen on a palace wall as background to a princely party or a public function. Folk song and folk dance were for the natives themselves. Now, however, the tourist sees less of the country than of its tourist attractions. Today, what he sees is seldom the living culture, but usually specimens collected and embalmed especially for him, or attractions especially staged for him, proved specimens of the artificial. Since the mid-19th century, international expositions have increased in number and grown in prominence. They usually have some solid purposes: to promote trade, to strengthen world peace, to exchange technological information. But when expositions become tourist attractions, they acquire an artificial character. From the London Crystal Palace Exposition of 1851 and the exposition on the Champs-Élysées in 1855, down to Chicago's Century of Progress Exposition in 1933-34, the New York World's Fair of 1939-40, the Brussels World's Fair of 1958, and the annual cinema festivals in Venice, modern expositions have been designed for propaganda, to attract foreign tourists and their currency. An exposition planned for tourists is a self-conscious and contrived national image. It is a pseudo-event for foreign consumption. The rise of tourist traffic has brought the relatively recent phenomenon of the tourist attraction, pure and simple. It often has no purpose but to attract in the interest of the owner or of the nation. As we might expect, this use of the word attraction as a thing or feature which draws people, especially any interesting or amusing exhibition, dates only from about 1862. It is a new species, the most attenuated form of a nation's culture. All over the world now, we find these attractions, of little significance for the inward life of a people, but wonderfully saleable as tourist commodity. Examples are Madame Tussaud's exhibition of wax figures in London. She first became known for her modeled heads of the leaders and victims of the French Revolution, and the Tiger Balm Gardens in Hong Kong. Disneyland in California, the American attraction which tourist Khrushchev most wanted to see, is the example to end all examples. Here indeed, nature imitates art. The visitor to Disneyland encounters not the two-dimensional comic strip or movie originals, but only their three-dimensional facsimiles. Tourist attractions serve their purpose best when they are pseudo-events. To be repeatable at will, they must be factitious. Emphasis on the artificial comes from the ruthless truthfulness of tourist agents. What they can really guarantee you are not spontaneous cultural products, but only those made especially for tourist consumption, for foreign cash customers. Not only in Mexico City and Montreal, but also in the remote Guatemalan tourist mecca of Chichicastenango and in far-off villages of Japan, earnest, honest natives embellish their ancient rites, change, enlarge, and spectacularize their festivals so that tourists will not be disappointed. In order to satisfy the exaggerated expectations of tour agents and tourists, people everywhere obligingly become dishonest mimics of themselves. To provide a full schedule of events at the best seasons and at convenient hours, they travesty their most solemn rituals, holidays, and folk celebrations, all for the benefit of tourists. In Berlin, in the days before the First World War, legend tells us that precisely at the stroke of noon, just as the Imperial Military Band would begin its daily concert in front of the Imperial Palace, Kaiser Wilhelm used to interrupt whatever he was doing inside the palace. If he was in a council of state, he would say, "With your kind forbearance, gentlemen, I must excuse myself now to appear in the window. You see, it says in Baedeker that at this hour I always do." Modern tourist guidebooks have helped raise tourist expectations, and they have provided the natives, from Kaiser Wilhelm down to the villagers of Chichicastenango, with a detailed and itemized list of what is expected of them and when. These are the up-to-date scripts for actors on the tourist stage. The pioneer, of course, was Karl Baedeker, 1801-1859, of Leipzig, whose name long since has entered our language as a synonym for his product. He began offering his package tours in print at the same time that Thomas Cook in England was perfecting the personally conducted package tour. Baedeker issued a guidebook to Koblenz in 1829, first in German, then in 1846 came his first foreign language edition in French. In 1861 appeared his first English language edition. By the beginning of World War II, the Baedeker firm had sold more than 2 million copies of about 100 different guides in English, French, and German, the languages that reached those nations with rising middle classes, who were now strenuously adapting the Grand Tour to their more meager budgets and more limited education. Despite the setback of the war and the destruction of the Baedeker plant in Leipzig by the Royal Air Force, 50 new editions were published in the decade after 1950. In the single year 1958, about 80,000 Baedeker guides were sold at a price of nearly $5 apiece. At this rate, within 25 years, as many Baedekers would be sold as in the whole previous century. Karl Baedeker himself was a relentless sightseer. In the beginning, he refused to describe anything he had not personally seen. His guidebooks have held a reputation for scrupulous accuracy, leading many tourists to share A.P. Herbert's faith. "For kings and governments may err, but never Mr. Baedeker." A testimony to Baedeker's incorruptibility was his statement in an early edition that "hotels which cannot be accurately characterized without exposing the editor to the risk of legal proceedings are left unmentioned." Baedeker saved his readers from unnecessary encounters with the natives, warned against mosquitoes, bedbugs, and fleas, advised wariness of unwashed fruit and uncooked salads, told the price of a postage stamp, and indicated how much to tip. Over-tipping was a cardinal sin in Baedeker's book. Eventually, Baedeker actually instructed the tourist how to dress and how to act the role of a decent, respectable, tolerant member of his own country, so as not to disappoint or shock the native spectators in the country he was visiting. By the early years of the 20th century, Baedeker was prompting the English reader to play this role. "By his tact and reserve, and by refraining from noisy behavior and contemptuous remarks in public buildings, hotels, etc., and especially from airing his political views, The Englishman's customary holiday attire of rough tweeds, plus fours, etc., is unsuitable for town wear in Italy. The traveler should refrain from taking photographs of beggars, etc. Baedeker's most powerful invention was the star system, which soon had as much charm over sightseers as its namesake later came to have over moviegoers. His system of rating gave 2 stars to sites that were extraordinary: the Louvre, Yellowstone Park, Windsor Castle, St. Peter's, the Uffizi, the Pyramids, the Colosseum. 1 star to sites of lesser rank, merely noteworthy, and no stars at all to the mine-run tourist attractions. This scheme, later copied or adapted by Baedeker's successors, Russell Muirhead of the successful Blue Guides and Penguin Guides, and numerous American authors of guides, has dominated the uneasy, half-cultivated modern tourist. Hermann Göring, instructing his Luftwaffe in 1942, is said to have directed them to destroy every historical building and landmark in Britain that is marked with an asterisk in Baedeker. These were sometimes called the Baedeker Raids. Anyone who has toured with Baedeker knows the complacent feeling of having checked off all the starred attractions in any given place, or the frustration of having gone to great trouble and expense to see a site, only to discover afterward that it had not even rated a single asterisk. Tourists versed in one-upmanship, who visit some frequented place like Paris or Florence, have been known to concentrate their sightseeing on unstarred items, so that in conversation back home they can face down their plodding acquaintances who go by the book. But the star system, like the public museums and the whole phenomenon of middle-class touring, has been a byproduct of the democratic revolutions. It, too, has helped blaze an easy path to cultural sophistication for millions. As Ivor Brown shrewdly observes, this star system has tended to produce stargazers rather than explorers. The tourist looks for caricature. Travel agents at home and national tourist bureaus abroad are quick to oblige. The tourist seldom likes the authentic, to him often unintelligible, product of the foreign culture. He prefers his own provincial expectations. The French chanteuse singing English with a French accent seems more charmingly French than one who simply sings in French. The American tourist in Japan looks less for what is Japanese than for what is Japanesey. He wants to believe the geishas are only quaint Oriental prostitutes. It is nearly impossible for him to imagine that they can be anything else. After all, he hasn't spent all that money and gone all that way over there to be made a fool of. The no, or kabuki, or bunraku, which have long entertained the Japanese in their distinctive theatrical idiom, bore him. But he can grasp the Takarazuka girly show, a Japanesey musical extravaganza on the Ziegfeld Billy Rose model, distinguished from its American counterparts mainly by the fact that all the performers are women. The out-of-dateness of its manner he mistakes for an Oriental flavor. Even the official Japanese Tourist Bureau guidebook, anxiously reminding the American that in Japan he will not fail to find what he wants, notes that striptease performances are advancing somewhat artistically. The Takarazuka extravaganza is described at length as an opera peculiar to Japan, known as the girls' opera. Like its Frenchy counterpart, the Folie Bergère, which is sometimes featured in Las Vegas, a Takarazuka-type show from any country will be a box office success in the United States. As the obliging foreign producers work harder to give Americans just what they expect, American tourists in turn oblige by becoming more and more naive, to the point of gullibility. Tourists, however, are willing gulls, if only because they are always secretly fearful their extravagant and expensive expectations may not be fulfilled. They are determined to have their money's worth. Wherever in the world the American tourist goes, then, he is prepared to be ruled by the law of pseudo-events, by which the image, the well-contrived imitation, outshines the original. Everywhere, picturesque natives fashion papier-mâché images of themselves. Yet all this earnest picturesqueness too often produces only a pallid imitation of the technicolor motion picture which the tourist goes to verify. The Eternal City becomes the site of the box office hit Roman Holiday. Tourist pilgrims are eager to visit the actual scenes where famous movies like Ben-Hur and Spartacus were really photographed. Mount Sinai becomes well known as the site about which the Ten Commandments was filmed. In 1960, a highly successful package tour was organized which traced the route of events in Leon Uris' novel Exodus. The next year, El Al Israel Airlines announced a new 16-day tour, which promised to cover the very places where Otto Preminger and his film crew had shot scenes for the movie version. The problems of satisfying the tourist expectations of a great middle-class market were summarized in a government study, 1936, under the auspices of the Union of South Africa and the South African Railways and Harbors. Supply of tourist attractions. In the wake of advertising and demand, creation must ordinarily follow an organized and systematic supply. If publicity has been given in foreign countries to the national tourist attractions of a country, and if a demand has been created therefore, then it is imperative not only that that which has been advertised should come up to reasonable expectations, but that it should also be ordinarily available and normally accessible. So, for example, if animal or native life is made to feature in foreign publicity, then as such it must be ordinarily available to tourists. Under no circumstances should any aspect of animal or native life which is not ordinarily present be made to feature in a country's tourist publicity. Thus it is wrong to make a feature of native initiation ceremonies or native dances which are only seen on rare occasions, since in their true character they have ritual significance. The sightseeing items which can be confidently guaranteed and conveniently and quickly delivered to tourists on arrival have these merchandisable qualities precisely because they are not native expressions of the country. They cannot be the real ritual or the real festival. That was never originally planned for tourists. Like the hula dances now staged for photographer tourists in Hawaii, courtesy of the Eastman Kodak Company, the widely appealing tourist attractions are apt to be those specially made for tourist consumption, and the tourist demands more and more pseudo-events. The most popular of these must be easily photographed, plenty of daylight, and inoffensive, suitable for family viewing. By the mirror effect law of pseudo-events, they tend to become bland and unsurprising reproductions of what the image-flooded tourist knew was there all the time. The tourist's appetite for strangeness thus seems best satisfied when the pictures in his own mind are verified in some far country. 5. So far, I have been writing about foreign travel, tours to distant places. I have shown how Americans going to remote parts of the world have been transformed from travelers into tourists by the very same advances which have made travel cheap, safe, and available. A similar transformation has been going on here at home. Even within the United States, to go from one place to another is no longer to travel in the old sense of the word. Not only because, as we often hear, the culture of different parts of the country has been homogenized, so that wherever you go in the United States you see the same motion pictures, hear the same radio programs, watch the same television shows, eat the same packaged foods, select from the same ice cream flavors. We all know how desperately chambers of commerce work to create local color, how auto license plates advertise unreal distinctions. Alabama is the heart of Dixie. Arkansas is the land of opportunity. Illinois is the land of Lincoln. Maine is vacation land. Minnesota has 10,000 lakes. North Dakota is Peace Garden State. All this is obvious. But in addition to this, the democratizing of travel, the lowering cost, increased organization, and improved means of long-distance transportation within our country have themselves help dilute the experience. Even here at home, we are little more than tourists. Traveling, the Swiss novelist Max Frisch observes, is medieval. Today we have means of communication, not to speak of tomorrow and the day after. Means of communication that bring the world into our homes. To travel from one place to another is atavistic. You laugh, gentlemen, but it's true. Travel is atavistic. The day will come when there will be no more traffic at all and only newlyweds will travel. That day has almost arrived, not because we no longer move about the earth, but because the more we move about, the more difficult it becomes not to remain in the same place. Nearly all the changes in foreign travel have appeared with equal or greater effect in domestic travel. Organized domestic conducted tours have grown only recently. In 1927, what is claimed to be the first escorted tour by air was planned by Thomas Cook and Son. It was an excursion from New York to Chicago to see the Dempsey-Tunney fight, in which the famous long count occurred. Since this was even before any regular passenger air service between the cities, the trip was made by chartered plane. In recent decades, the multiplying conventions of professional organizations, trade associations, unions, fraternal groups, and the employees of large firms have supported the domestic travel business. As late as 1928, the Travel Department of American Express was sending only 5 or 6 tours out west each year, and for each tour, 18 people were considered a good crowd. Then, an enterprising new manager of the Chicago office sent 120 members of the Chicago Athletic Club on a tour to Alaska. A special train took Chicago doctors to the annual convention of the American Hospital Association in California. 2 shiploads of Spanish-American war veterans were sent to Cuba, and 300 electrical workers went to Miami. A new program of packaged Western tours was then developed. Even during the Depression, these tours somehow stayed in demand. In the Depression summer of 1933, at the opening of the Chicago World's Fair, American Express did over $1 million worth of business within a single month and handled nearly 250,000 visitors to the fair during the season. At the close of the fair in 1934, American Express organized the annual Rotary Club convention in Mexico City. A Pullman city was brought down to house Rotarians taken there to see Mexico. In 1936, American Express expanded its banner tours, and in the summer of 1939, it sent out west 22 special trains on all-expense tours. Since 1928, the domestic excursion business of American Express has increased 100-fold. The items have ranged from expensive grand tours of the West and the Canadian Rockies, priced at nearly $1,000 apiece, to a bargain package 3-day tour of New York at $19.95, in the course of which the traveler stays at a well-known Midtown hotel and does the metropolitan area from Bear Mountain to the Battery, including seeing the Hudson from an excursion steamer, Chinatown, Greenwich Village, a baseball game at Yankee Stadium, and an evening at Billy Rose's Diamond Horseshoe. It rather makes a native New Yorker believe in miracles. The growth of tourist attractions, or better, baiting of tourist traps, has been unprecedented in recent years. From the grandiose Disneyland, which we have already noted, and its smaller imitators, Freedomland, Frontierland, etc., to the Plaster of Paris covered wagon and Indian teepee filling stations, and museums now lining highways in Kansas and Nebraska. The preeminence of Yellowstone National Park as a tourist attraction is doubtless due to the fact that its natural phenomena, its geysers and paint pots, which erupt and boil on schedule, come closest to the artificiality of regular tourist performances. They are nature imitating the pseudo-event. The automobile itself has been one of the chief insulating agencies, and the insulation has become more effective as we have improved body design from the old open touring car to the new moving picture window, through which we can look out from air-conditioned comfort while we hear our familiar radio program. The whizzing cross-country motorist stops at his familiar trademark, refueling at a gas station of uniform design. His speed makes him reluctant to stop at all. On a train, it used to be possible to make a casual acquaintance. The Pullman smoker was a traditionally fertile source of jokes and folklore. Now the train is dying out as a means of long-distance travel, and if we travel by air, we are seldom aloft long enough to strike up new acquaintances. But for meeting new people, the private automobile is the least promising of all. Even hitchhikers are slowly becoming obsolete as well as illegal. The nationwide route numbering system, with its standardized signs of the new era, was adopted in 1925 by the Joint Board of State and Federal Highways, supposedly to eliminate confusion from the motley array of signs which differed from place to place. Even before our new transcontinental superhighways, it was not necessary to know where you were, provided you could remember the number of your route, or where you had to go to reach your destination. Today, when we ask directions, we usually inquire not for a place, but for a number. Superhighways have been the climax in homogenizing the motorist's landscape. A friend of mine recently drove his family from Chicago to New York on one of these tollways. His boy had heard about prosperous Ohio farms and wanted to visit one, but this proved too difficult. Once on the superhighway, with not a traffic light to stop them, they seemed more remote than ever from the environing farms. Where would one leave the toll road? How and where could one return? As late as the early years of this century in the United States, the general demand was for roads extending only 2 to 5 miles from railroad stations. Then, the Federal Highway Act of 1921 began to coordinate state highways and to standardize road-building practice. The Federal Aid Highway Act of 1944 established the new National System of Interstate Highways, an arterial network of 40,000 miles planned to reach 42 state capitals and to serve 182 of the 199 cities in the country having populations over 50,000. There has been an increasing tendency to concentrate road improvements on these most used roads, which become more and more like one another in every respect. The 700-odd thousand miles of federal aid roads, primary and secondary, make up only a quarter of the total rural road mileage in the United States. Yet, they serve almost 90% of the total rural highway travel. An increasing proportion of passengers go over well-traveled roads. The better traveled the roads, the more they become assimilated to one another. Economy and good engineering require that they traverse the dullest expanses of the landscape. Increase in motor travel, both for business and pleasure, has changed the character of lodgings en route. Formerly, the motorist seeking good lodging en route had to detour through the heart of the city. There he could not avoid a view of the courthouse, the shops, the industrial, commercial, and residential districts. Now the motel makes all this unnecessary. Meanwhile, city planners and traffic engineers, hoping to reduce congestion in urban centers, spend large sums on bypasses and superhighways to prevent the long-distance motorist from becoming entangled in the daily life of their community. Motor courts sprang up during the Depression of the 1930s. The earliest tourist cabins were simply a cheaper alternative to the hotel, resembling camping facilities. But within a decade, motor courts were improved and standardized. In 1935, the first year for which the Department of Commerce reported statistics, there were about 10,000 motels or tourist courts. After 20 years, there were some 30,000. The new chains and associations of motels soon enabled a motorist to use the same brand of soap, the same cellophane-covered drinking glasses, and the same sanitized toilet seats all the way across the country. The long-distance motorist, usually anxious to avoid the business route, then needed to wander no more than a few hundred yards off the superhighway for his food and lodging. What he secures in one place is indistinguishable from that in another. One thing motels everywhere have in common is the effort of their managers to fabricate an inoffensive bit of local atmosphere. The next development has been the luxury motel, with its stateroom-sized sleeping rooms, fabulous bar, and deck-sized swimming pool. It now resembles nothing so much as the luxury ocean liner. Getting there is half the fun. Tourists and business travelers relax in luxurious surroundings. The motel passenger, too, is now always in mid-ocean, comfortably out of touch with the landscape. On the new interstate speedways, we see the thorough dilution of travel experience. The motels, which Vladimir Nabokov has brilliantly caricatured in Lolita, are the appropriate symbol of homogenized American experience. Although, perhaps because, no place is less any place than a motel, people nowadays vacation in motels for a week or more, as they used to relax in luxury liners. They prefer to be no place in particular, in limbo en route. Some new tourist restaurants on superhighways. Fred Harvey has a large chain of these of uniform design, appropriately called oases, are actually built on top of the highway, on a bridge, to which speeding motorists have equally easy access, regardless of the direction in which they are going. There, people can eat without having to look out on an individualized, localized landscape. The disposable paper mat on which they are served shows no local scenes, but a map of numbered superhighways with the location of other oases. They feel most at home above the highway itself, soothed by the auto stream to which they belong. Now it is the very improvements in interstate superhighways, at expense to the federal government alone of $500 million a year, that enable us as we travel along to see nothing but the road. Motor touring has been nearly reduced to the emptiness of air travel. On land, too, we now calculate distances in hours rather than in miles. We never know quite where we are. At home, as well as abroad, travel itself has become a pseudo-event. It is hard to imagine how further improvements could subtract anything more from the travel experience. 6. Not so many years ago, there was no simpler or more intelligible notion than that of going on a journey. Travel, movement through space, provided the universal metaphor for change. When men died, they went on a journey to that land from which no traveler returns. Or, in our cliché, when a man dies, he passes away. Philosophers observed that we took refuge from the mystery of time in the concreteness of space. Bergson, for example, once argued that measurements of time had to be expressed in metaphors of space. Time was long or short. Another epoch was remote or near. One of the subtle confusions, perhaps one of the secret terrors, of modern life is that we have lost this refuge. No longer do we move through space as we once did. Moving only through time, measuring our distances in homogeneous ticks of the clock, we are at a loss to explain to ourselves what we are doing, where, or even whether we are going. As there comes to be less and less difference between the time it takes to reach one place rather than another, time itself dissolves as a measure of space. The new supersonic transports, already in the design stage, will take passengers across our continent in less than 2 hours, from Europe to America in 2.5 hours. We are moving toward instant travel. It is then, I suppose, thoroughly appropriate in this age of tautological experience that we should eventually find ourselves measuring time against itself. We call ours the space age, but to us space has less meaning than ever before. Perhaps we should call ours the spaceless age. Having lost the art of travel on this earth, having homogenized earthly space, we take refuge in the homogeneity, or in the hope of variety, of outer space. To travel through outer space can hardly give us less landscape experience than we find on our new American superhighways. We are already encapsulated, already overcome by the tourist problems of fueling, eating, sleeping, and sightseeing. Will we enlarge our experience on the moon? Only until tourist attractions have been prepared for us there. Even our travel literature has shown a noticeable change. Formerly, these books brought us information about the conduct of life in foreign courts, about burial rites and marriage customs, about the strange ways of beggars, craftsmen, tavern hosts, and shopkeepers. Most travel literature long remained on the pattern of Marco Polo. Since the mid-19th century, however, and especially in the 20th century, travel books have increasingly become a record not of new information, but of personal reactions. From life in Italy, they become the American in Italy. People go to see what they already know is there. The only thing to record, the only possible source of surprise, is their own reaction. The foreign country, like the celebrity, is the confirmation of a pseudo-event. Much of our interest comes from our curiosity about whether our impression resembles the images found in newspapers, in movies, and on television. Is the Trevi Fountain in Rome really like its portrayal in the movie Three Coins in the Fountain? Is Hong Kong really like Love is a Many-Splendored Thing? Is it full of Susie Wongs? We go not to test the image by the reality, but to test reality by the image. Of course, travel adventure is still possible. Nowadays, however, it is seldom the byproduct of people going places. We must scheme and contrive and plan long in advance, at great expense, to be assured that when we arrive, there we will encounter something other than the antiseptic, pleasant, relaxing, comfortable experience of the hundreds of thousands of other tourists. We must fabricate risks and dangers, or hunt them out. The writings of Richard Halliburton, The Royal Road to Romance, 1925, The Glorious Adventure, 1927, New World to Conquer, 1929, The Flying Carpet, 1932, and Seven League Boots, 1935, became popular at the very time when travel for thousands of Americans was becoming a bland and riskless commodity. To make a glorious adventure out of travel, Halliburton had to relive ancient adventures. Like Leander, he swam the Hellespont. He retraced the routes of Ulysses, Cortez, Balboa, Alexander, and Hannibal. Even mysterious Tibet, one of the few remaining places on earth which physically challenged the traveler, has had its mystery abolished. Recently, Justice William O. Douglas has shown ingenuity in seeking out travel adventures. His books are understandably popular, but they too are only a blander version of Richard Halliburton. Pierre and Peg Streit ingeniously make adventure by motoring by English Land Rover from Paris to Kathmandu in Nepal, a jouncing tour of Kipling's Wild Land. Life, September 2, 1957. Nowadays, it costs more and takes greater ingenuity, imagination, and enterprise to fabricate travel risks than it once required to avoid them. Almost as much effort goes into designing the adventure as into surviving it. For this, the tourist millions have not the time or the money. Travel adventure today thus inevitably acquires a factitious, make-believe, unreal quality, and only the dull travel experience seems genuine. Both for the few adventuring travelers who still exist, and for the larger number of travelers turned tourists, voyaging becomes a pseudo-event. Here again, the pseudo-event overshadows the spontaneous, and for the usual reasons. Planned tours, attractions, fairs, expositions, especially for tourists, and all their prefabricated adventures can be persuasively advertised in advance. They can be made convenient, comfortable, risk-free, trouble-free, as spontaneous travel never was and never is. We go more and more where we expect to go. We get money-back guarantees that we will see what we expect to see. Anyway, we go more and more not to see at all, but only to take pictures. Like the rest of our experience, travel becomes a tautology. The more strenuously and self-consciously we work at enlarging our experience, the more pervasive the tautology becomes. Whether we seek models of greatness or experience elsewhere on the earth, we look into a mirror instead of out a window, and we see only ourselves.